Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. My guest tonight is Gino McGahey. He is a producer, a director, and a writer.
Hello.
Hello, Gino. This is Mac.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Oh, good. We are on the air, just so that you're aware of that. So you ready to jump in?
I am ready.
Okay. So why don't – oh, I'm sorry. You were going to say something else?
Oh, no. I think I chuckled. I think that's what it was.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's a little overlay sometimes, and I can't tell when people are talking. It's Blog Talk Radio. So tell us about growing up in Massachusetts and when you really knew that you were ready to start making your own films, and, you know, what interested you, who were your inspirations, things like that. Because I know you started early. You were like 12. So tell us all about that.
Yeah, I was a writer from birth. From 5 years old, I was writing stories, and the 1980s rolled around, and my parents ended up getting one of those VHS-loaded camcorders. And so I started writing my stories in screenplay mode and thought it would be kind of cool to start just making skits with my buddies. And so before I knew it, you know, we were making these silly skits like every weekend. And that led to me eventually working at a video store with the plan to get some sort of film I created into the video store. And that led to my first feature, which was Evil Awakening, which not the best film in the world, but it was my start, and that actually got me into distribution, and that sort of led me. You know, I was maybe 21, I think, when Evil Awakening was made, and so from that point on, it's kind of been like feature film, but what got me into it was just this natural writing thing that I have. And when I saw that I could translate that to like a visual medium, I couldn't resist it. And it's just basically led me to where I am now.
Hmm. Yeah, when I was introducing you, as I was calling you, I was telling people that you're a director, a writer, and producer. And I've noticed that you do all three for almost everything that you do. Do you have a preference of which one you like to do? Probably writer. I don't know. I'm just guessing since you said writer from birth.
You know, I think writing is something that I've always kind of had. The other stuff was initially kind of almost uncomfortable because I'm kind of introverted. So becoming a director was something that took some getting used to, but it's very tough for me to now say which one I like the best. I guess the producer part, you know, the financing stuff kind of stinks, but directing brings me right into the mix, and I've met the best people in the world by doing it. So from my mind says writing, my heart says directing. Because when I'm in that mix and I'm seeing it all come to life and I'm meeting these people that just have this fire in their heart, it really, really means a lot. My best memories are like film memories. And so I would maybe even edge director over writer by just a hair.
Hmm. Yeah, there's something to like about each thing, I guess, but each person is different. Some people don't have a preference. Some people do. Because I know in the independent circle, most people do like everything. They'll be the producer, the writer, director, the boom operator, anything, the grip. They do everything. And usually they have certain things that they really don't like to do. They only do it because they're an independent and they don't have anybody else to do it because they don't have the money to pay them. And that's and that's why in the independent movies you got people hiring their family and their friends. But of course they do that in Hollywood too. They get their friends and family to be in movies with them. They just maybe pay them more.
Yeah, I think it is the norm. Like I know in my first couple of films, I was getting people I worked with, people I'm friends with, you know, whoever raised their hand and said, I want to be in a movie, you know, was in the movie. And I definitely look forward to the day when I'm not taking down my own lights and packing up my own vehicle. That would be nice. But there is something to be said for the love of the game. Like I think when you work and you see people you work with, actors that have really no responsibility to do anything outside of act, walk over and start taking down lights and carrying things, you become, I think, more of a family. And not saying that you're not a film family in Hollywood, certainly that exists there, but I think there's something so genuine, because there's not a lot of money when you're making an independent film. It's more about your love of the game and your respect for each other.
Yeah, I'm telling people all the time, because some people will say, oh, well, that movie was crap and it had bad this and bad that. And I said, look, you got to realize that it takes time to make a movie and it takes money. And when you don't have much of either one, but you want to make a movie, you do the best you can. And most of these things that people are calling crap aren't crap. Because I've watched crap, and I'll tell you, most crap that I've seen comes out of Hollywood, not low-budget
movies.
So,
I totally agree with you that there is something to be said for that, because if someone's making a movie and going into their own bank account and rolling the dice on a very low-odds gamble, there's obviously some love of the game in there.
Oh, yeah.
From a personal experience, you know, I've put money into my own films where I'm like, okay, this money I probably won't see again, but it's something I want to produce. And I've been relatively fortunate, thankfully, with some films doing good, some films not doing so good. But each one is like a child. You create something that doesn't exist anymore, something special in there. And I'm with you as far as people dismissing things that are lower budget because they don't look like the stuff that you see, you know, from big Hollywood. But if the story is tight and the heart's in the film, I think that's stuff that can resonate if people can allow it to.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of the really low budget or no budget, I mean, I've seen some movies that you could tell there's no budget. But I think one thing that helps me realize is I've got friends and family in the business. And I'm also a semi-professional movie reviewer with different places and different people. And usually my friends will ask me to review their movies. And I always make sure they really want me to, because whether you're my friend or not, I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm not brutal. I'll just say, well, I didn't care for it, or I did care, or I really loved it, or, you know, whatever I think personally. But then I'll also point out things that other people might like, even though I didn't like it. Other people may like it, or vice versa. I really like it, but somebody else may not like it. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, well, you know, it's being in the same game as you, I have been reviewing films for 20 years, that if you're in the game, if you're putting yourself out there, you have, especially if you're asking to be critiqued, I don't know why you would want anything other than an honest critique, good, bad, or indifferent. I don't ever want anyone to watch my film and say they loved it just because they're trying to make me happy. I want them to be honest, and that's what people should want. But a lot of people are like artistically fragile, and they need that pat on the back that says, "Yeah, I love it. It's the best thing ever." And I've had it happen with my website, where I've reviewed movies from filmmakers that I was on friendly terms with, and I gave a honest review, and they've come at me hard with negativity and with anger and attacked my work. And I'm like, if you didn't want a review, why did you ask me for one in the first place?
Yeah, usually I do okay with the friends that I do reviews for, even when they're not really favorable, but except for one, and it was pretty bad. And it's somebody pretty famous, and that's probably what it was, is that because they're famous, they thought that I should give them a favorable review, whether I liked it or not. But I reminded them before I did the review, and I said, I'm going to be honest. You know, if I like it, I'll tell you. If I don't like it, I'll tell you. And so after I did it, he asked me, he said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, you know, I'll have a written review for you that I'll send to you. And do you want me to tell you over the phone? And he said, yeah, I want to hear over the phone. And I said, well, I didn't really care for it. And then he started getting mad. Well, what do you mean you didn't like it? And I said, I didn't care for it. Some people like certain movies and some people don't. It doesn't necessarily mean the movie is bad. So then I was even saying, it doesn't mean your movie is bad. It means that I didn't like it. And I said, why don't you read? Yeah, why don't you read what I wrote? And then you'll understand what I mean. Because there are some good things about the movie, but there are some bad things about the movie, in my opinion. It's only my opinion. But he got all mad and was yelling at me. And then he sent me some nasty emails and texts, and then he blocked me on Facebook, and it was like,
wow.
All because, yeah, and I was nice about it. I said there were some good things about it, there were some bad things about it. And then on the other side of that coin, somebody asked me to review their movie, and it was a war movie, which I don't particularly care for those. And for anybody listening that already heard this story, sorry, but I'm going to tell the story again. Because my guest didn't hear the story, at
Correct.
Least not that I'm aware of.
So, I have not.
So his movie was a war movie, and I said, well, I don't really like war movies, but you know, I also have a lot of war movies that I do like. It's just one of those things that you cannot really care for a specific genre, but that doesn't mean that you don't like any of the movies in that genre. It just means, as a general rule, you don't care for them. So I watched the movie, and it was, you know, okay. And the special effects were a little lacking, but I understood that they didn't have a lot of, you know, money. So I took that into account, and I ended up, I use a 0 to 5 stars when I do my reviews, and then I use partial stars. And I had given him a 3, and he said, oh, wow, I didn't expect to get that high. He said, everybody's been giving it a really bad rating. I've been getting 1s and 2s on IMDb. And I said, well, as you know, a lot of people, when they do the reviews, especially on those venues, they don't even watch the movie. They just want to spread some hate and give you a 1 because they feel like giving you a 1. But when I critique a movie, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was agreeing with you 100% that there are people out there. And usually they know you, and they're hiding somewhere in your Facebook friends list, and they can't handle seeing anything positive, and so they'll pounce, and IMDb is a good war zone for them to jump into.
Exactly. And then it brings ratings down, and then when you're trying to make movies, a lot of the people now look at those ratings, and that's what's not good, because a lot of people didn't even watch the thing, but yet they're saying, oh, it's terrible. But I don't do that. And even if I give a whatever rating I give a movie, I will even say in my review, that I didn't care for this, you know, whatever it is, but somebody else may love it. And then I also say the opposite, depending on what it is. I love the cinematography. So if you love good cinematography, you may love this. And then there's a lot of movies that have good location shots. I
yep.
watched a movie that there really was nothing good in it. The acting was, I hate to say terrible because everybody tries, but
sure.
it was like school, like being in, you know, high school. But
right.
they weren't terrible. The directing left to be desired. The editing left something to be desired. Really nothing was quote-unquote good about it except the location. So I really, really talked that up about the location shop because they really were great. They were great location shops. And
mm-hmm.
other movies, it's cinematography. Other movies, it's acting. Everything else may be bad, but the directing is good or the acting is good. So whatever is good, I point it out. I usually don't point out bad stuff when I'm writing a review that's going to be published in some way, whether it's on the back of a DVD or whether it's in a magazine or wherever, whatever venue it's going to be published. I almost
right.
never put anything negative in those. Even if I give it a low score, I'll just say I didn't care for it, and then I might mention why I didn't like it, but I don't go into brutal details. But when I find things that I like, I make sure that I really talk those up. And it would be almost impossible. It would be almost impossible for somebody to get a one star from me simply because the way that I rate, and I won't talk too much more because this is your show. Sorry
no, no,
to
no
talk
worries,
so
no
much.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
The way that I do ratings, because I know the kind of things that go into making movies, you get an automatic one just for the effort.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, you're going to get a little bit of something for everything. So it would be almost impossible for you to get a one or lower.
Yeah.
But and then after that, what I do is everything that's good, I give certain numbers. It just depends. Like if the acting is decent, I'll give it a half a star. If it's, I'll give it a quarter star. If it's really good, you get another star. So just for good acting and the effort of making the film, you've already got two stars. Then after
that's awesome.
That, I start looking at the directing and the editing and the cinematography. And because like I said to my guest, not last night, but Wednesday night, if you don't have good editing, you don't have a good movie.
Oh, absolutely.
So I make sure that I include editing because I notice that. I know when there's a bad editor. So
The film's made in the editing room. That's the thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That if you don't have good editing and you don't have good sound, and there's a lot of elements that go into it that, you know, are like a turnoff for film. And editing is incredibly important because you can have all the great footage in the world. If it's put together in a bad way, you're going to have a mediocre film. It's amazing.
Right.
I've seen films edited differently by different editors, and they're completely different movies. One can be fantastic, and one can be bad, and the thing is that they're both working with the same material. So the editor might be the MVP of the game.
Yeah. And music is also very important to the movie, the choice of music. And when I say music, I mean any kind of music that's in it, whether it's the theme or music that's going on while stuff is happening. And because music has a lot to do with the reactions from people. I saw this documentary, and
mm-hmm.
it was about a bunch of movies, not just the movie that I'm going to mention, but it included this little thing on Psycho. And what they did was the shower scene, you know, where she's getting bludgeoned with a knife,
sure.
they played it but they played it with this like crappy music, and I was like, what? And it's like, you don't feel anything. But then they played it with the music that was in the film, and it's like, ooh, you get a completely different feeling.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And then they, and then they showed this other movie with this guy with in a cape, and he's running, and I'm laughing, you'll see why, but he's running through the word just went out of my mouth, I mean, out of my head, cemetery. He's running through a cemetery. And they're playing the William Tell 1812 Overture, as he's running, which is, you know, that's a bouncy thing. And it's like he couldn't help but laugh as this guy. But when they play the stuff from the movie, you're thinking, oh, that's creepy. But with the other music, it's like, and then they showed how even your homemade movies to be the same thing, because they had a homemade movie from somebody, and it was their kid's birthday party, and so they put music to that. And the music that they put to it was a nice, lighthearted little music, you know, that maybe somebody was playing on a record, but they said that they didn't. They just, and then they put music into it, the people that made the documentary, and it was spooky music, and you were looking all around waiting for the waiting for the killer to come out.
It's amazing how that
Go ahead.
I'm totally with you, because like I know I've seen like a lot of trailers where different people take like comedies like Miss Doubtfire, and they'll make like a horror trailer of it, and they'll add different music and add different cuts, and it's pretty interesting how the music does affect. It's such a big piece of it. Like people, you know, like we were saying before, the people that are quickly to jump on something because it's lower budget don't understand the different elements that go into a film and how much work and preparation. You know, making a film is the craziest thing in the world, the most difficult thing. You know, I always say, like, you know, I probably, you know, would have been happier if I was, you know, a painter. I'd just sit there and paint. I'd only have to worry about affording my paints. But it's a film is in my blood, and it's so much work. And so I can understand filmmakers that get their feathers ruffled when they don't get patted on the back. But I was fortunate to have a relative hit by my standards early on, and I was in my, you know, mid-20s, back when I didn't have this thick skin I have now. And my film Rise of the Scarecrows hit everywhere. It was did really well, and unfortunately or fortunately, it landed in everyone's lap, and people were trashing it everywhere. And it was kind of like a double-edged sword for me at the time, where I'm glad it's out there, but then again, you know, taking all these hits, people telling me, don't give up your day job, you know, and in worse stuff. But in the end, I sort of like sifted through it, and I learned a lot, because a lot of the stuff I was getting hit with was constructive. A lot of it was just negative, just to be negative, but a lot of it was constructive, and I sort of like learned a lot. So in my mid-20s, I started to realize that I put myself out there, this is the reaction, and I just have to take it and just understand that whatever I can learn from it, I will learn, and that's kind of motivated me to get better and better. So I don't mind anyone if their intentions are pure. If they say, Gino, this is, I think this could have been done better, I'll certainly evaluate it, because I always want to get better and I always want to improve. So I never ever look at a criticism as something bad, unless it's coming from a source that really, really hates my guts. And there's a few of those guys somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of along the same lines of how I feel, and other people, not just me, but when people say things to me. Because when I was younger, I was always worried about what people were saying to me. Oh, you're fat. Oh, you, four eyes. I mean, it was always something. Somebody always had something nasty to say. And just because they wanted to make you cry or see if they could make you cry. And I admit a couple times I cried because of some of the things that people said to me, because it was really nasty, horrible things that people were saying to me.
Sure.
And then when I got older, I was like, I don't care what anybody thinks. one time I think I was in my 40s, and I'm standing in line at this grocery store, and this 20-something, I don't even think he was 20. He may have been like 18 or something, and he was standing behind me with his buddies, and he said, "Hey, lady," and when I turned around, I said, "What?" And he said, "You got a really big butt." And unlike what I did when I was younger, I just smiled and said, "Well, then I guess you like big butts or you wouldn't be looking at mine." And his crew just busted up laughing and said, "She schooled you." And he got so mad, he stomped out of the store because he couldn't get the reaction that he thought he was going to get.
Oh, yeah. And that's, Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, no. It's okay. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was saying that's the, you know, the thing, like, because I think any artist had to go through bullying because we're typically a person that's quiet. And so, you know, I've gone through the whole gauntlet of dealing with bullies and things of that nature. And now I look back on it and a lot of me just says, you know, we were all kids, and I don't know what they were going through at home, and who knows? They could have been beaten by their father, and they need someone to unleash it on. And so I don't hold any ill will towards anybody, but certainly I'm in a different frame of mind. Like, there is wisdom that comes with age. So certainly you putting those punks in their place is fantastic. And I'm with you there. Like, there's not much that can be said to me now that hasn't already been said or that I can't contend with. Or I very rarely do I go home at night and sit on my couch and cry. I'm pretty happy and not worried about if someone doesn't like me or someone, you know, insults anything I do, because I do all kinds of things so they could, you know, not like the way I sculpt clay or I don't know, work on my swimming pool, whatever they want to choose to critique. I welcome it because it's not really going to change my day.
Right. And I'm at the point now, being 62, and that's one great thing about getting older. I mean, there's not too many good things about getting older. But that's one of them, is you get to where you really don't care what people say. Like, you want to say that about me? You know, good for you. One lady I was working with, she come up to me and said that somebody was saying bad stuff about me, that I was, and at the time I was married, and they said that you were messing around with so-and-so. And I said, "Yeah, and?" "Well, yeah, aren't you worried about your husband finding out and getting mad?" And I said, "Well, first of all, my husband would know better."
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not that way. He wouldn't just believe somebody telling him that I was out messing with somebody. That's number one. Number two, I don't care about gossip. You don't care? How could you not care when people are saying bad stuff about you? And I said, here's the way I think about it. If people are talking about me, that means I'm interesting.
Right.
That's the way I look at it.
And you can't get, like, this. I'm with you. Like, there's. I've had people hit me up in Facebook Messenger that were friends or were associated with me in some way, and have just gone off on these strange, aggressive rants. And I'll never give those a time of day. They're not worth the time, because what they're looking for is chaos. And the minute you reply, they get what they want. And so they can sit there and stew, because unless you have something productive or unless you have something that I can get something positive from, I'm not going to play the game of defending myself or just feeding into your anger. And there's a lot of angry, defeated people out there. It's crazy.
Yeah.
How many people are out there that are just completely defeated, not going anywhere, and that they, you having some sort of aspiration can trigger anger from them. And I've learned that I've considered friends, that you don't expect everybody to be happy for you at all times, because sometimes they're so angry at the world that they'll turn it on you. So I guess, like I'm saying, with the gossip stuff, you're great not to entertain it, because the minute you entertain it, you're now hip deep in it, and it can only get worse from there.
Yeah. And I really don't care what people say about me. I did it one time, like I said, but now in my 40s when that happened, care about that. Why should I care about that? I had a good husband. I for one thing, I wouldn't be doing anything because I had a good husband.
Right.
Now, if I had a husband that beat me or berated me every day, I might be messing around, but not when I got a good one, I'm not going to.
No, and that's probably why they went after you, because they, and you know, people don't always like happiness, and they like chaos. So to see you in a good marriage probably irked a few people.
Oh, I know that it did, because people would be complaining about their husbands all the time, and they'd say, "Don't you hate it when husbands do that?" And I said, "I'm not saying this to brag, but I'm just saying my husband doesn't do that."
Mm-hmm.
Or he does do that, whatever it was that was being talked about, because one time they were talking about how their husband would never mop the floor that they always had to, even though they both worked. And I said, "Well, mm-hmm. you're the one letting him get away with it."
Yeah.
My husband mops the floor, washes the dishes. He does anything that needs to be done. It's not that he's like a slave to me or anything. It's just that we're both working, then we share the housework.
Well, that's the way
because
it should be.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it all, and he's not going to do it all. Because why should we? We're both working. But now if I was, and we settled all that before we even like moved in together.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if we both work, we share the housework. I work and you don't, you do the housework. You work and I don't, I do the housework. And he said, no problem. And that's the way it was for our whole married life.
Well,
and
that's, you know, that
they got really jealous about that.
Well, and that's the whole thing. Like I'm with you there too, because I would feel kind of awkward just coming home from work and just sitting around while everything was done around me. You know, I think being like ambitious or whatever, and also I'm a control freak. So you mix that in together. I like to control the dinners. I like, you know, plus I'm sort of a neat freak. So if I see something dirty, my natural inclination is to clean it up, and none of that makes you, like, I don't know, less of a man, I guess, for lack of a better term. It's just as a married couple, as a family, there's certain things that need to be done, and if you do them, great. If the spouse does them, fantastic. As long as they're done, they're done. There shouldn't be any sort of negative critique for either side for doing any chore.
Yeah. Oh, and to not just mention housework, it meant any kind of work. Because I mowed the lawn, I took out garbage. That wasn't a husband thing to do. It was, you know, whosever day it was, that's who took it out or whoever mowed the lawn. But most of the time I ended up mowing the lawn simply because he worked the day shift and I worked the night shift. So when he came home and got his dinner and everything, by the time that was all done, it was kind of late, and, you know, there's laws that you can't mow your lawn at certain times of the night.
Sure.
And so I would do it because I was home during the day, so I'd do the lawn, and I didn't care about doing it. I actually like mowing the lawn.
Oh, yeah.
But that's how I ended up doing that. But, well, sorry to talk so much, but actually that is part of my show. But I did want to go over at least a couple of your movies. So
sure.
If you don't mind, we'll move on to that. But
I don't mind at all.
It was nice having it was nice having that little chat with you. Thank you.
Oh,
sorry about
no,
taking up time.
Don't be sorry.
Now, you did mention, and I'm going to have you talk about those simply because you mentioned them and also because they're like your first ones. But that Evil Awakening You don't have to tell us a lot about it, but just give us a rough idea of what it was about and anything you want to tell us.
Sure, sure. Well, long story short, 1996, I made a very short film with my buddies called An Evil Awakening, and it became like a strange, like, town hit where people had copies of VHS copies, and it sort of like put us on this little baby map of local characters. And I had started working at a video store, and long story short, there were these magazines that the video stores would get, and then in one of these magazines it said, if you want to make it in film, then make a horror film on digital, and it can be low budget. And so I had thought about rebirthing the short film, An Evil Awakening, into Evil Awakening, and just to get into the seven chain mom and pop store I worked for. And so long story short, we filmed it, and it's basically a Friday the 13th knockoff that's completely absurd. I was watching, you know, Jackass and all these other really strange and rude programming, and it was kind of infused into Evil Awakening. But Evil Awakening thankfully did okay and became the drinking game for a lot of people, so something good came out of it. And then I followed that with Rise of the Scarecrows, which was the one that put me on the map. And in the infancy of Netflix streaming, right when it came out, they picked up Rise of the Scarecrows, and before I knew it, the movie that was made on $300 was, I was getting checks for $14,000, and I'm like, holy cow. I'm like, I'm in business now, and eat that, haters. And so it was, from that point on, it was just, I thought that there was some business in this. There was some, you know, this path is the path I want to take. And here I am 20 some odd years later, and I'm still on it, and things are going incredibly well, better than ever. And so, yeah, those two films, Evil Awakening, Rise of the Scarecrows. So that's like the first chapter of my life. And I used to kind of think like, okay, I want that chapter to kind of be hidden somewhere. But I'm as proud of that as I am of anything, because without those two films, no one would know who I was. You know, it was my introduction, and now we're here. And my current film, A Christmas Invitation, which is a non-horror film. It's about a dysfunctional family that has one. There's a grandmother's dying wish to get them all together and during the holidays, and hopefully they can survive it. And so it's about redemption, and it's about love, and it's about the Christmas spirit and all that stuff. So it was nice to make something that wasn't horror, and also for it to become by far my most successful film. I'm still riding high off of it, and very excited that people are watching it and liking it. So many people have already watched it. It's crazy.
Yeah, most people like a variety of films. There are some people that, oh, I don't like horror. Oh, I don't like this. But what's great about it is when you can get people to actually watch the stuff. I'm one of those people that can do it, because when I was, even when I was 17, I could do it. Because I wanted this woman to go to, and she was an older woman. She was like somebody that went to my church. And I wanted her to go to see Star Wars with me. And she said, well, she didn't like science fiction. And I said, well, it's science fantasy. Yes, technically it's science fiction, but it's not like other science fiction. I think you should watch it first and then say whether you like it or not. How can you say that you don't like it when you haven't seen it? So she's like, oh, okay. So she goes to see it with me. Saying before, she said that she knew she wasn't going to like it because she didn't like science fiction. She loved it.
Yep.
And she went to see it multiple times, because that's what happened in 1977. People went to see that movie 50, 60, 70 times in the theater. Well,
yeah,
anyway, sorry.
No, you're right, though. It's nice to like kind of span over genres, because I mean, from my standpoint, I went into horror. Horror is the genre I embrace the most. And when you're at the point when I was making almost no-budget films, you can make a no-budget horror and people will watch. If you make a no-budget war movie or comedy, or people aren't going to watch it. So I had to find something, and I kind of got my claws into horror for a long time and kind of got afraid of the other genres because, you know, once you get your feet planted, you're kind of like almost afraid to jump to the other side. But my wife, she was watching the Hallmark Christmas movies about 10 years ago, and she was so I was sitting on the couch and I started watching them with her, and I started to think, well, you know, I think I can, you know, do better than this. And not to disparage Hallmark, but I just like, I bring more grit, I think, and I have more of a, you know, a chaotic history. And I like my family that I grew up with was all screwed up. It's something where I could kind of incorporate all of it together. And thankfully I was able to do that. And now it's kind of like the handcuffs are off. You know, my next movie is going to be, the one I film here in Massachusetts will be a comedy movie. I got two films that I'm filming in March in California, which is crazy. And times are just good. It's amazing what you can do when you just keep on pushing forward and just, you know, never lose hope. I always say consistency and drive are the two biggest things in the world.
Yeah, you're exactly right. One thing I did want to make sure to have you talk about is mainly because I saw it on your Facebook page, because I just was like going scrolling through and I saw that your film Family Secret, that you said that you want to remake or reboot it. It's on like your list of things to do. So
sure.
Tell us about the film, and if you do remake it, if and when, how do you think you're going to do it?
Well, Family Secret, after Scarecrows, the first Scarecrows, I had kind of given up film. I felt like I was the only one that was serious about it. And realistically, at the time, I surrounded myself with people that weren't film people, so they weren't serious about it. And because of the money I've made off the original Rise of the Scarecrows, I decided to give it one more shot. And I mean, Family Secret, which is about this guy. He's a journalist, and his grandmother dies, and now what appears to be the dead grandmother is now killing family members. So it's kind of like a murder mystery. And who's behind the man? Who's behind the grandmother costume, right? And so I think I had the right idea in 2008 when I wrote it and I produced it. I just don't think I had the know-how technically. Like, I didn't shoot it as well as I should have. I didn't have the best audio in the world. I didn't have the best acting in the world. And so now that I'm at this point where I have such great talent around me, I've learned about how to make things technically right, how to shoot things better, how to make sure that everything meets the specs. So should these streaming services watch it, it'll pass and it will be able to be viewed by people. And so when I remake Family Secret, which is my plan is for not this year, but next year, I'm going to do it. It's going to be not as many characters. My plan is kind of like condense it, make it scarier and make it more surprising and make the granny killer look even more menacing and have younger characters, because I didn't have a lot in that first film, and make it almost like a, you know, like a Scream sort of film, and hopefully one I can build on and make more movies out of. But yeah, it's definitely a done deal. That's definitely one that I need to do. There's a few films in my head where I'm like, these films I have to do to be satisfied with this journey, and A Family Secret reboot is one of them, because I think that the first one was so good. It was such a big step up for me. The idea was there. It's just the execution wasn't, and I think I'm pretty confident in what I can do now, and I know I can bring something much, much better, and where people won't tear it down on the technical stuff and the streaming services won't turn their head because of the technical stuff.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're going to be doing a good movie there. Is there anywhere that people can see that first one? Like on YouTube?
I wish. Unfortunately not. You know, the sad thing is, like, with the streaming services, it is really technical. I don't blame them. The audio and Family Secret should have been much better. It's just I was, you know, I just didn't know at the time. And so I'm hoping that maybe I can throw it, you know, free on YouTube, or it'll find a streaming home at some place that understands very low-budget films that have some, you know, problems. Because I think, like, it's a great film. I think people, if they can, you know, it's not like the audio is terrible. It's just not up to the level that it needs to be. So people that watch it can walk away and hear everything well. It's just I didn't have the best audio equipment in the world, and I learned a lesson. And so hopefully, you know, hey, anyone that's pirating it online, I'm sure you can find it pirated online. This will be the one time I encourage people. You find it pirated, go ahead, have a good time, watch it. Let me know.
That's funny. Well, you think that they're going to understand bad sound, because there's a lot of famous movies that have bad sound. And one of them is the original Night of the Living Dead. That has terrible sound. And it has lots of audio mistakes in it. Like he's hammering the wall, and you see his hand move, but you don't hear anything. And when he stops, you hear the hammer.
Yes. It is. It is crazy. I, you know, I'm hoping, you know, like I said, the Christmas movie is doing so well, and I have so much other stuff that's coming out. I do have, like, if people find me on Tubi, they'll find a bunch of my movies, so they'll be able to see some of my work, and I think right now I have the momentum, so maybe if I keep on moving forward and my name keeps getting out there, maybe they'll give Family Secret a second glance and say, well, you know, because his other films are doing well, he can make money, we can make money, let's throw it up there. But like I said, if anyone finds it anywhere, considering it's nowhere, I encourage people to watch it and give it a shot, and give my other stuff a shot if they'd be so kind. I think they may like some of it.
Well, there's got to be something to like in it. I mean, that's the way I look at it. But I don't go to a movie like wanting to not like it. I go into a movie wanting to like it. That's how I know I'm objective. I want to like the movie.
Well, and I'm in the same boat with you. Like, there was a recent film, Jeepers Creepers Reborn, and I was watching all these reading all these terrible reviews of it, and I'm like, I got to watch this because it can't be as bad as they say it is. And I ended up watching it, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really decent movie. So I think you're right. I think people walk in that they almost have this negative chip on their shoulder. They're ready to strike. Let me find something that's wrong with it so I can talk about it. And then that's too bad because I think, you know who I blame for this? I blame American Idol. I remember back in the day, Simon Cowell trashing everybody, and then it took off. And I think that's translated to social media and to movie reviews because people want reaction, and it's hard to get reaction when you say, oh, this is a fantastic movie, everyone should watch it. You get more reaction when you say this is, you know, you should wash your eyes out with acid before you watch this or whatever they say.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, we're down to like 10 minutes and 30 seconds or so. So I wanted to make sure that we went over those two that you actually mentioned a little earlier. You just didn't mention them by name. The two movies that you have coming up in Hollywood, Fatal Justice is one and Boiling Point is the other. So you've got about 10 minutes and 15 seconds now to say whatever it is you want to say about both of those.
Oh, awesome. Excellent. I am going to California to work on two films under the banner of Cinema Epic, working with some great actors, including Eric McKellion, Laurie Bacon, Brent Northup, Chris Spinelli, Nicole D'Angelo, just great, great people that I've wanted to get together for a long time. So in Fatal Justice, we have a guy who's alleged to have killed a very young girl in her 20s, and because of some police misconduct, they threw the case silent. He's a free man. And so the family get together, and they end up kidnapping him and put him on their own family trial. And so it's sort of like a suspense with some twists and turns. I'm really, really excited about this adventure and this shooting in a new location and shooting under basic ideal circumstances. And the other film that I'm shooting up there is called Boiling Point, which is my first Western. And that's about a sheriff that wakes up and doesn't know who he is and is dealing with this group of bad guys that are basically taking town by town, and his town is next up. So he really doesn't know who he is or what's going on, and he kind of has to get everything situated in his own head. But there's plenty of twists and turns, and I'm a Twilight Zone fan, so it's kind of like my Twilight Zone episode, I guess. But it's both films will be shot in March, and that will lead to me coming back to Massachusetts and filming a comedy movie, which I'm very excited about, which is about two brothers that don't get along, that have to put their differences aside to save their parents who are separated because the dad is like shacking up with a 20-year-old and blowing through the family fortune. And so it's and it's a zany comedy in the sense of like Step Brothers and then Freddy Got Fingered. It's very different for me, but doing the Christmas movie gave me the hope and drive that I can make a comedy and I can write freely and be silly. And thankfully so far, all three screenplays have gone over incredibly well. We're ready. My group here locally are very ready to go to California and team up with the Cinema Epic team over there and do our best and create some movie magic and have a good time. I can't wait. It's going to be a good year. This year is going to be the year where I have the most productions come out, so I can't complain. So I didn't go the full 10 minutes. I ramble. I talk too quick.
Well, no, that's okay, because I'm always ready for things. So, because I have some other stuff we can go over, but, you know, it would have to be quickly. But since you did talk fast, going back a ways, this one, because I like horror anthologies. So you have one called Scary Tales, and then there was a sequel, Scary Tales Last Stop. So tell us about those two.
Sure. Scary Tales, the original, was a horror anthology, as you said. It was great to produce. I was, amazingly, anthologies are the easiest things to produce. And so I was just writing down these film ideas, these short film ideas, and it was right after Family Secret. And I thought, well, I have this group of people that want a film, so I'll make, this film Scary Tales. And Scary Tales kind of suffered from the same audio problems that Family Secret did, but it's more of your, 1970s, sort of like, almost like, I guess, cheesy grindhouse monster anthologies. In Scary Tales Last Stop, which was filmed, a good 6 or 7 years later, I had learned a lot. And that film has proven to be like one of my most popular. Next to My Christmas, it's probably my most popular, and that one has, and it has, more of a like a realistic look on life, and it brings together different people from different walks of life that are stuck at a train station, and they have all had bad dreams, and so they start explaining their dreams, and they start seeing similarities, and each dream is one of the stories in the anthology. And they sort of see a connection with each other, and soon, strange things start to happen. So those two anthologies, especially Last Stop, like Scary Tales Last Stop is the gift that keeps on giving. I always get messages about it. It always does well on Tubi. And it's something I take great pride in, because that was the first time I really stepped up to production level and the acting level. And that was the first time I ever put Sasquatch in a film. It won't be the last, but it was the first. And I think you can't lose with a Sasquatch.
No, you can't. Sasquatches are great.
Oh, yeah, I love them.
Or Yeti or Bigfoot, whatever you want to call them. I still like them. I don't care.
I'll even take that skunk ape of a Louisiana. He's okay, too.
Yeah. let's see. We've got a little over 4 minutes. So I'll just have you, like, if there's a movie that you want to mention that you want people to really try to see it, you may or may not have something like that. But just to say whatever you feel like saying in the last, now it's like 3 minutes and 45 seconds.
You betcha. Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me on the show. It's been fantastic. And I really encourage anyone to see my two latest films, which are Rise of the Scarecrows, Hell on Earth, which is a kind of a reboot sequel of my 2004 hit. This one, everything was much better. The production value was better. So I'm hoping you enjoy that. If you like Jason Voorhees films, this was one you may dig. A Christmas Invitation, you know, if you like Hallmark movies or if you like Christmas movies, if you want some Christmas joy in your heart, I hope you give it a chance. And that one, thankfully, is just about everywhere, you know, Pluto TV, Tubi, Sling TV, Redbox, you name it. Yeah, I also encourage anyone to go to my website, scaredstiffreviews.com, where I have a lot of bad ramblings. I review movies, I interview people. And you can read some of my chaos there. Also, Tubi is where you can find a lot of my movies. So if you throw my name in there, you can watch my films and you can hit me up. You can find me on Facebook. I'll answer any message I get, good, bad, or indifferent. And hopefully you like what I do. I really appreciate anyone that watches my film, even if they don't like it. The fact that they take the effort to sit down and press play and watch it, that means a lot to me. So thank you to everyone that has watched my films, that have made my Christmas movie a big hit, and thank you for having me on this show. This hour has flown by. I've had a great time.
Well, I'm glad you had a good time, and it's been my pleasure because you've been a great guest. And we've got like 2 minutes left, so I mean, I can end it at any time. We don't have to completely go to 2 minutes. We just have to be careful if it's too long, because Blog Talk Radio will cut you off in the middle of a sentence if
oh,
you
no.
go over. but quickly, because we have 1 minute and 30 seconds, if you could just tell people how you prefer to be contacted, whether it be Facebook or Instagram or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Facebook is probably the best way, but if you go to my website, scaredstiffreviews.com, there's a comment box, and that comment will be shot right to my email, and I'll respond, you know, within a day or so, gladly. You can find me on Twitter. You know, I'm just starting to really use Twitter, so I'm happy to communicate through there. I check that every day. Either one, Facebook, my website, Twitter, I will be there. And I look forward to any comments, questions, reviews, whatever. I really am interested to see what you guys think of my films, and especially my last two, Rise of the Scarecrows, Hell on Earth, and The Christmas Invitation.
Okay, thank you. Now, I want to thank you for being on the show. You've been a great guest, as I said earlier. And I just want to remind everybody that my guest tonight has been Gino McGahey, and make sure that you watch his films, especially A Christmas Invitation and the Scarecrow's Hell on Earth movies, his two latest ones, and be waiting for Fatal Justice and Boiling Point. And now I have to end it. So thanks again, Gino.
No, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this.
Okay. Have a good night. Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.